Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to another Motorsports Magazine podcast. Now, you might be wondering where Never Missed a Podcast Rob Widdows is. Well, he's out at the Nürburgring 24 hours. So you've got me today, Ed Foster, and I'm joined by Nigel Roebuck, Simon Aaron, and a very special guest, but more on him in a bit. First of all, I'd love to tell you about our latest subs offer. Now, without these subs, we wouldn't be doing the podcast, so please listen carefully. At the moment, you can sign up for 12 or 24 issues of Motorsport, and you will receive Simon Taylor's Motorsport Greats book absolutely free. The Motorsport Greats book is a compilation of all the best Lunch With articles that he's done in the magazine from 2006 to present, and they are a truly great read. So that's 12 or 24 issues and receive his book absolutely free. Prices start at $49.99. So how to do this? Go to motorsportmagazine.com/PODMB. That's pod and then the initials of our guest. motorsportmagazine.com/PODM for mother B. So our guest. He's an ex-Formula One driver for Tyrrell, Zach Speed, Brabham, Benetton, Ligier, McLaren, and Jordan. He was a test driver for Williams, and he won the Le Mans 24 Hours. On his day, he beat Ayrton Senna. He beat Michael Schumacher. But despite all of this, most of us know him as the guy who walks up and down the Formula One grid chatting to the drivers before the start of each race. Yep, you've got it. It's Martin Brundle. Well, Martin, a very warm welcome. And if my sources are correct, you're fresh from a seat fitting, are you not?
I am. I've been at McLaren this morning in the MP423, the car that crossed the line when Hamilton won the World Championship in 2008. We're doing a feature in June. I think there are four McLarens. We're trundling around the track in them. So interesting to see it on grooved Bridgestones, reminding me just how awful they looked, but they probably went reasonably well. And also how messy the car is. I mean, it's a glorious looking thing, but it's got pieces hanging off it left, right and centre.
Yeah, I must confess, I mean, you say glorious looking. I actually thought that year, right, Bernie is right, we've got to get rid of all this rubbish.
It's not a good looking car, but it's just, you look at it and the
a potent looking thing, for sure.
It's just a channel of air. Basically, that sort of marginally resembles a Formula One car.
You mentioned the Bridgestone tyres there, and we will be talking about Pirelli today. We actually, before the podcast, we asked for readers to send in some questions, and the first one was, can we do 2 hours instead of one? I think he was probably referring to the Pirelli. We've just heard that Pirelli won't be making changes this year because there were rumours of going back to the 2012 spec. That's been thrown out by the FIA. Martin, you were quite vocal on the Sky website saying it's gone too far. I take it you're still very much for that.
Yes, I have. I'm fundamentally in favour of what Pirelli are doing, and I applaud them because I think what they've spiced up the action. It's just gone too far, and I think it's confusing for the fans. It's confusing for everybody when the cars are spending more time in the pit lane than the pit straight on occasions, and 80 stops or such like, and drivers radioing in going, I can't go any slower, and shall I just let this guy past? And it's gone too far. I do think we should have two or three stops in a race would be optimum for me, and I'd like it to be just on the cusp of two or three, shall we say. So it's so you've got a bit of the unknown, a bit of excitement towards the end of the race. And clearly for me that means that one tyre that's really not very good at all and another that's reasonably consistent and works. But it, we've got drivers now starting on a Friday morning thinking only about saving tyres, setting their cars up. And I saw a lot of comments in the week about, well, you know, races were won with four stops before, so what's the difference? Well, there's a huge difference because they were won with some kind of banzai 20 lapper at qualifying pace, having to overtake other cars without assistance, i.e. The DRS or KERS or what have you. So I think we did need some spice. You've got to think back to Fernando Alonso following Petrov and losing the 2010 World Championship and many other instances. And I go back to the early 2000s when we knew not only which team was going to win the race, it was which car, and the championship was over by August. We'd have an ad break at ITV and me and Murray would look at each other and shrug our shoulders as much as say, what are we going to say now when we come back on air from the ad break? And back in those days, we used to have to talk to the rest of the world as well in between and make something up. And so I think we did need something, but I really think that Pirelli 2013 is too far.
I mean, perspectives change, don't they? And I'm sure that's the presence of TV is fundamental to that, but people talk about the Schumacher-Ferrari era in the early 2000s as being a little bit dull and predictable, pedestrian, etc. You go back to the 1963, for example, Jim Clark used to win most races by a fortnight if the Lotus didn't fall apart, and we talk then only of artistry and elegance and innovation. Nobody says that was boring, but the actual outcomes were pretty similar.
But was that not the diehard F1 fan? And what Formula One now?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I think with the presence of TV now, it's become a more sort of entertainment thing.
It was. I think the only point I'd make on that, because I was, you know, going to Formula One races in those days when I was still a kid, but I was there. And I think it's funny. I mean, I saw that the famous picture of Chris Amon at Alton Park at Old Hall Corner in the Ferrari the other day, which is a famous picture, been used loads and loads of times. And I was at Old Hall that day, and that was how he was taking that corner every lap when he was chasing Stewart, you know, in a full-blooded opposite lock power slide. And that was to drive cross-ply tyres, you know, in that car, that was the quickest way to drive it. And I think there's an element of, I mean, I could stand and watch that all day long. You didn't need constant overtaking when you had that spectacle. And I think, I'm sad to say, but I'm afraid a lot of this sort of spectacle has been lost in the sense that the cars are so efficient now. That you quite wrongly, but you do sometimes get the impression, if I could hold on to it, I could probably do that. Of course, you couldn't. But when you saw a car sideways at 150 miles an hour, you know, you knew that instant you couldn't do that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Martin, you drove, was it Ferrari last year, Fiorano? Mm-hmm. How, you know, compared to the cars that you were driving, it was obviously a different breed.
But it was brutal. But it, you know, you spend your life as a racing driver coming in at the end of every day and hours on end with maps and understeer one in and oversteer two in the middle and talking to your engineer and worrying about your spring rates, your anti-roll bars, your dampers, your bumpy rebound, your ride heights, and you're looking for perfection all the time. And fast forward a few years and you jump in a car like the 2010 Ferrari. Next week I'm in the 2011 Red Bull, the one with the fully blown floor under tray, and which I think will be an immense thing to drive. And they are just brilliant. They do all the things you ever wanted a racing car to do, and they're brutal. I actually had to, because I was talking into microphones in my crash helmet and I had a camera strapped to my chest. I couldn't breathe properly. I was pushing that Ferrari around Fiorano. I had to get off the throttle. I couldn't get any air in. I was drowning. I couldn't get any air in my body. They are physically so demanding. But we can't, you know, but change the fact that we have aerodynamics, we have slick tires, carbon brakes, and I don't really look through rose-tinted glasses even to the 80s, because you could cruise home in sixth place in my day in the 80s with turbos, two laps behind. Now you're lucky if you can be 12th, if you're a few seconds off the pace, as it were, or you had a slight glitch in a pit stop or something. So the game has changed, and I think we have to change with it. And Simon touched on it about the media and what the young people expect today, and we're losing young people. They're not watching Formula One. We have to give them some interest, some excitement, and we have to, yeah, really the aficionados will sit and wait and enjoy a Hakkinen passing Schumacher moment up at Les Combes in Spa that day, as we all do. We can all picture that in our mind, and that magnificent, you know, goal or move at chess or whatever. But the vast majority of people, they've got too many things to go and do. They won't sit and wait for that moment and savour it.
Yeah, I mean, Paul Hemring, when I spoke to him in Bahrain, said there are thousands of TV channels. If Formula One doesn't get it right, then someone else will. I mean, okay, here's a question. I think we all agree that the Pirelli tyres is a necessity because of the viewing figures. But if you were given, you've been to nearly 500 Grand Prix,
yep,
as a driver, commentator, pundit, the regulations are in your hands. Where do you go with them? How do we solve it rather than using tyres that only last a few laps?
Well, I think some of the tools we're using, and I have this conversation with Nigel over lunch, normally with the help of a bottle of Amarone or something, where it gets quite feisty. But you have to have something, otherwise the cars, we know, you know, if you spend all weekend sorting out who's the fastest and who's the slowest and line them up in that order and then have tyres that will not degrade, where's the surprise when that's the order they finish in? And nobody wants to watch that. That's boring. You know, we had people complaining about it being boring. Now, we have to be very careful with social media these days because, you know, you get a small sample of what people are, you know, the most vociferous people are thinking. But when you start looking at ticket sales and, grandstands and you're looking at TV numbers and all that, people vote with their remote control and their feet. Basically, if they're not finding it interesting. So what would I do? I think fundamentally what we've got is not bad. I think the qualifying format is good, fundamentally and generally. I'm not against DRS, providing it's a device which at least gives you a chance to overtake. Because I quite like, if a driver's had a problem, I quite like him to be able to come back through the pack now and rejoin, as it were, and instead of being stuck behind a car and a driver combination that is not competitive, yet they can't pass them. KERS is here to stay, isn't it, because of the eco aspects, the green aspects of it. So I think the ingredients we've got are about right. They're just too extreme.
Do you think, Martin, one thing Ross said when I was talking to him not long ago, he just said, I think what I definitely think is we don't need these tyres and DRS.
I think that's probably correct, although there'll be tracks we go to where, you know, the DRS works brilliantly. In other words, it puts the driver alongside and skills, you've got to finish it off with skill, not watching a world champion who you hugely respect sitting there with a driver you don't respect as much cruising past him like he's a new boy. That feels wrong, doesn't it? And it feels plastic and fake and not interesting. It's like doubling the size of the goalpost, isn't it? And having a football match, you know, Chelsea v Man U that ends up 15-12 or something. It loses its impact.
Yeah. I mean, Nigel, you've always used the example of Weber overtaking Alonso through Eau Rouge, which was just the pass of the season. But then a lap later, it was all undone because of DRS. But then Pat Simmons argues that, well, if that driver just been overtaken by DRS was fast enough, he could do the same the next lap.
Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, that pass at Eau Rouge is one of those things, I don't know about you, but every time I see it, I still can't believe it's going to come off, you know,
no,
with them both
of
them getting, both them
the
getting through.
Yeah. I was heading out the back of the commentary box. I thought it was going to be an aeroplane crash.
And I thought it was interesting that Mark said to me the only people he would have, in the paddock, he would have tried that with were Fernando and Jensen.
Hmm.
Which is an interesting comment.
Yeah, but we can't. I don't think we can. I don't think we can microanalyze every single point that happens in a Grand Prix and go, see, there, look, that proves my point. Or that. We can all find little bits and pieces that prove our point irrefutably. You've got to look at the bigger picture and whether, you know, not every race can be an all time classic, can it? It just can't.
No, it can't. But sorry, Simon, forgive me.
I'll get a word in sooner or later. So you two carry on.
Point I just wanted to make. I don't think they are as much faster than GP2 cars as they should be.
The cars?
Yeah, in the race. I just don't. No, I think there should be a vast difference and it's much less than it was.
The drivers are not pushing flat out at any point in the race. at any point, pretty much from Saturday morning onwards, they're just nursing. They're nursing everything, and they're thinking the long game. Still, the best drivers are winning the races and winning the championships. Of that, there is no doubt. But is it interesting for us to observe how they're doing it? Do we want to? You know, we get a lot more of this radio transmission as well that we never used to get. So, and you know, whether somebody's being quite how they're choosing which pieces of radio come across. You know, we get a very small percentage of the total radio called stuff. So,
do we know who chooses the radio messages that come over? Is he very pro Pirelli or anti Pirelli? Because it would seem he's quite anti Pirelli, isn't he?
I think they just go. For, I mean, I've sat in the FOM TV compound during a Grand Prix in Australia, 2012, and I mean, as Martin said, I mean, there's an awful lot of stuff that you hear through the headcans, which is very amusing, but it's not going to make broadcastable for TV. Who actually decides, you know, which bits do get filtered through? I don't know, but you hear voices saying, right, I've got a bit of commentary about Alonso talking about, you know, understeer through turn three or something. Do you want that? And then the director says either yay or nay. But just, I mean, something you said earlier about the qualifying format being essentially, you know, okay. Do you not miss the time when we, you know, you had four sets of tyres for an hour and it would build up, drivers getting faster, pushing harder and harder on each set, and you'd get this fantastic 10-minute burst at the end where everyone would go out and people would trip over each other and someone would find a clear bit of track and you get a fantastic kind of climax to the whole thing, whereas now you have four or five people going out to do one run and three or four cars in a garage. It's not quite the same, is it?
It's not, but I guess with my television head, I'm thinking of the whole hour because there's action for pretty much the whole hour, most of the time anyway. In the we've got certain cut-off points where it gets quite exciting. Who's going to make it through? That sort of knockout facility. Yeah, we did used to get that last lap, last two or three minutes of frantic action. But I think overall, it fundamentally works as a qualifying show. And the audiences back that up. You get really good audiences for the qualifying. They like the excitement of it. It doesn't work when Q3 is actually an anticlimax. Of course, we used to have the Friday and Saturday qualifying, but if it rained on Saturday or the track was dirty, nobody. I remember standing with Murray and we were well over half an hour before we saw a car on the racetrack. It's like, I keep using the analogy, but it's like watching an FA Cup final and they blow the whistle to start the match and nobody kicks the ball for half an hour. What would you do? You'd laugh and turn over, wouldn't you, after 10 minutes, because you wouldn't believe it's credible that this is going on.
It happens in cycling when they sit on the banking looking at each other for 10 minutes.
Now, we've got masses of questions in from readers, and you just mentioning Murray Walker, I remember there's a question here from Steve Hobbs. I think I know the answer to this. My question for Martin, who has been your favourite commentator to work alongside and why?
Well, I've enjoyed them all. Obviously, I'd have to say Murray because I learned so much from him and I spend longer with Murray than with anybody else. And it was the early days for me. So whilst I didn't actually want to go in the commentary box, I wanted to be a Formula One driver, once I got in there and I realised I quite enjoyed it, then it was fine. And Murray was magnanimous. We enjoyed working together. He was very helpful, very fair with me. And I learned a great deal from him, and it was the Murray and Martin brand. I wish it had carried on a little bit longer, actually. But then, you know, James, different character altogether. I remember James being told, don't be the guy that replaces Murray Walker, be the guy that replaces the guy who replaced Murray Walker. But James went for it, and all credit to him. Then we obviously had the move to BBC and Jonathan. BBC decided to change Jonathan. I tried it for a year, learned a lot. Quite enjoyed it, but I enjoy my current role more. I had a year with my mate DC up there. We had a good laugh. Now with Crofty, and he's got a different style, but it's an interesting style. He's got a turn of phrase, and it suits what we're doing. And I can go back now to thinking more about strategy and whether the tyres are going to make 22 miles or 24 miles, and go from there.
Were you not pulled into a commentary box for the first time because certain James Hunt had gone missing?
Absolutely. 1989, I think it was, or 91, my Brabham broke down and they were looking for anybody that could remotely speak English or even Norfolk, really.
Was that Spa?
Yeah, Spa. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I can't remember. I know I was driving a Brabham, so I don't know if it was 89 or 91. I suspect 91. And they would look anybody who could go up and help Murray out. We did. James was on the missing list, wasn't he? And he was... it was quite good fun. And I made my excuses to leave. And I remember Nick Britton, who was helping me out at the time, was like, going, why did you leave? Well, it sounded so good. Why did you go? I'm like, I want to beat the traffic out of the place. Traffic was horrific, wasn't it, back then? And I'm disappointed, you know, the car's broken down. And then again in 95, when I had half a Ligier drive, and I used to do Eurosport on the Saturday and BBC on the Sunday, just because I had nothing better to do, really.
Now, we've got to look ahead to Monaco. Is it going to be Mercedes putting their cars on pole and then blocking everyone up during the race, or is that really going to happen?
I think it's such an unusual racetrack. It's such a one-off that I kind of hate guessing. I love to go and watch and observe and enjoy rather than second-guessing, because it's all it is. I'm about data and understanding and explanation. I don't like just pulling something out of it. It does seem that the Mercedes is good on a fresh set of tyres, but Monaco's, you just rewrite the rules there, and the driver can make the difference. In Barcelona, I think you're pretty stuck with your the efficiency of your aero package. In Monaco, you can outperform your car, and I expect to see that happening all the way down through the field. And I'm really looking forward to that. It's for me, walking around the track at Monaco on the Friday or Saturday is the highlight of the year, of my commentating year. Yes, maybe the Merc will be really good on a fresh set of tyres. Will it hold people up in the race? If it's hurting its tyres, they'll still get past it in the pit stop phases or what have you. So I think the usual suspects will be at the front and the usual drivers in those cars. And I'm looking forward to it.
Michael did actually have the fastest time, didn't he? I know he didn't start from pole, because I can't remember what penalty, why he got a penalty, but he did actually set the fastest penalty.
Yes, he did. He was taking Bruno Senna out in Barcelona.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, yeah, I mean, he was quickest, yeah.
Absolutely. So, and the Red Bull's got a great front end on it as well, watching it out at Barcelona, which you need a good front end on a car in Monaco. You spend so long on slow apexes going nowhere that if you can just get the front end to stick, then you just light up the lap.
Nigel, with news in this morning that Paddy Lowe is going to Mercedes June 3rd, is that team, I mean, we thought it was top heavy before Paddy Lowe went there, but now I actually saw quite a good photo on Twitter this morning of someone did a mock-up of what Mercedes pit wall would look like, and there was like a double-decker bus with 10 people on it.
Yeah, I don't know. Actually, Martin, you had just been at McLaren's this morning. I don't know if you heard anything about it. I thought, how charitable of Martin Whitmarsh to... Presumably, they could have said, no, you're not going anywhere until the end of the year. So
you don't think there have been any cut-price Mercedes engine deals going on there?
Well, it's possible. Yeah. I mean, there is only 1 year left, and they don't want to pay more than they have. They have to. That's perfectly true.
I'd be surprised if Martin's just capitulated and let him go out of the goodness
for
his heart.
For nothing, yeah.
There's not some kind of quid pro quo going with that as well, but it's Martin's like that though. He's, you know, Martin. I was going to say he's a softie, but he's not a softie. He's a compassionate man, and he if the deal's done, he wouldn't. He's not bitter and twisted about that sort of thing. But I'm sure he gained some kind of upside. I mean, they've got to really. They've got 1 year of Mercedes Benz, and I know they're contracted to have the latest technology and the latest software and what have you, but I still can't. If I was going to war, I'd want Ross Brawn on my side. I wouldn't want him on the other side when it came to strategically being helpful to you. So I just think McLaren need to do all they can to make sure they got the best of what Mercedes will give them next year before they move to Honda.
And what about the other half of the question about Mercedes being top heavy? Well, it seems to me. I mean, I don't know, the impression I always have is it seems mighty top-heavy to me now.
It did, didn't it? So presumably one or two will be going. They've got the 2013 car and the 2014 car. They're throwing a lot of money at it. It looks quite confusing. I agree with you, it already looked a bit top-heavy. It's only a matter of time before Ross decides he's ready to retire, sooner than later. Ross is a good friend of mine. And I wouldn't want to give away any confidentiality, because Ross wouldn't tell you that sort of thing anyway. But he I think with Ross, it's a question of he'll go when he's ready, not when somebody else decides he's ready. And I think they've realised, despite all the banter of the winter and chest puffing, that day by day, minute by minute, so they need somebody there like Ross Brawn steering the ship.
That was something that really struck me in Malaysia, actually, right after the... multi 21 scenario. Ross's voice when he was dealing with Nico, when Nico was saying, please, you know, he wasn't sort of being like Sebastian and saying, oh, get him out of the way, but he was saying, please, I'm faster, can I go? And Ross was so implacable, wasn't he? Firm, implacable. And I just thought, yeah, that tone of voice, you would instantly say, okay, I obey you.
Yeah, that's Ross carries that kind of heavyweight sort of position, really. You're not going to go, well, I'll do it and I'll fight with Ross later. You're going to follow that one, and that's how he operates. And you take the upside of that as well. As one of his drivers, as I was at Jaguar, that confidence that he has and that authority helps you in other ways. So it's not smart to be dismissive of it.
No, and the thing with Ross, I mean, he's just such a weight of achievement behind him, isn't he? You know, you hear that voice, and it sort of half automatically triggers in your head what the man has done. And Christ, it worked pretty well for many, many, many years, didn't it?
Yes.
So I'm not going to go against it now.
It damages the drivers, doesn't it? DC never recovered from the 98 Mika Melbourne situation in some respects, in terms of his credentials, as his words, credibility. And I think it's really hard for the drivers because it does make them look submissive, makes them look weak. But you know that. I mean, I did a feature with for Sky F1 with Nico Rosberg that we put out last weekend in Barcelona, and we about the steering wheel. It was absolutely fascinating. We had to cut loads out to get it under 5 minutes. Now, 5 minutes on TV is a long time for a feature, and it was a lot of information in it. And the drivers, there's so much going on in the cockpit, and they know that others are managing tyre strategy, fuel strategy, and all of the things. So you must, if you're a sensible driver, you must think, they know a lot of things that I don't know. I've been busy driving this car for an hour and a half now. But it is very negative for the driver, and it makes them look weak. And well, it's interesting. What do you think about Vettel, what he did? Do you think that makes him look strong, if it can make you look weak to be submissive?
I thought it was interesting that he was very apologetic after the race, but he then went away and came back in China and was completely unapologetic about it and said, you know what, if I was in the same position again, I'd probably do the same. Which I thought was at least honest, but interesting that he went away and, you know, clearly realised he didn't care.
I think I said it in a previous podcast, it's just the there's the ruthless ambition that attaches to, you know, Alonso sometimes. When he passed Massa coming into the pits in Valencia that time, to Schumacher always, you know, some drivers have that edge about them. Senna had it, as you know.
But if Vettel wins the championship by a few points, everybody will have forgotten about the negativity of Malaysia.
I suppose so, but I mean, actually a deliberate disobeying of a team order. I mean, Simon's perfectly right about that moment where Fernando passed Felipe in the pit lane.
Which I thought was terrific, incidentally.
I thought, well, that's the difference essentially between the two.
Absolutely.
But on the other hand, actually to disobey a firm team order, I think you really are calling into question where the authority in the team lies, aren't you?
But every racing driver, every professional racing driver after Malaysia, and I had this discussion with my son actually, would have thought, would I have done a Rosberg or would I have done a Vettel? What would have been the right thing to do? And if I was advising a young driver, I'd have done a Vettel and sorted it out later.
Yeah, maybe. But in that case, don't sign up to the team orders in the first place.
Yeah.
That's my grievance with Vettel. If Vettel, when this whole multi 21, multi 12 thing was discussed, and it must have been at some point, that was when he should have said, I'm sorry, I'm not interested in any of that. I'm going for it, and that's the end of it. So you now you all know where you stand, and that was the thing. I mean, I'm sure initially Mark did think, Christ, what's going on?
I do think Sebastian must remember that I thought Jacques Villeneuve summed it up better than anybody else afterwards. You've got to win with honour, and he can still win lots of championships, lots of races, without that negativity surrounding him.
But, I mean, did Senna always win with honour? Did Schumacher always win with honour? They have millions of fans around the world. It's funny how it pans out. You know, there's obviously a line, and for some, Vettel didn't cross it. He's just the exciting kid, as it were.
If you want to be considered one of the all-time greats, I think you have to be able to win and then win with honour as well. Is there such thing as honour in sport anymore?
See, I couldn't understand Berger's point when he was talking about Vettel, and he just said, no, 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 you can't criticise him because, you know, that's not how his brain works. And Senna was the same. And I thought, well, you know, where do you draw the line of this? Any behaviour is forgivable. You know, if, well, he's a bit odd, you know, he's not quite normal, so you must expect this sort of behaviour. Mm. I just thought, that's ridiculous. You know, Senna did what he did because he chose to do it, and Vettel the same.
But Vettel, I think, did damage the team in Malaysia by he weakened the team. He made it clear that he was the de facto team principal. He's in charge of the place.
And you do think to yourself, don't you, does Mark lie awake at night sort of dreaming of Interlagos and giving Sebastian a chop and letting Fernando through?
But I thought Mark wasn't very smart in Interlagos. I know, but there's so much history there. I think none of us know the full story. Because I remember saying at the time when I was commentating on Interlagos last year, I was surprised how brutal he was with, and in many respects, the way he chopped him into T1 is what put Seb on his back foot down there into T4 when he made a hash of turning in there and collecting Senna and all. It could have cost him the world championship.
But I tell you what, though, when you were saying earlier on, you know, about DC being damaged by what happened in Adelaide.
Melbourne.
It was two races in the trot there, wasn't it? Because
it was, yes. And you've got to say in the same.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Way does what happened to Silverstone with the, you know, with the front wings, is that always going to linger in Mark's mind? When it comes to it, he gets what he needs.
I'm told that Mark tried that front wing and didn't like it, and that's why Sebastian had it. But now that's one side of the story.
Mark's expression in the post qualifying conference didn't suggest that tallied really. Nor did his reaction at COPS the following afternoon.
Well, and the other thing is, you'd have thought Christian would have mentioned if that had been the case, he would have made a big thing of it at the time, wouldn't you?
But where does this leave Mark? Is he going to sports cars next year, as many people believe, or will he just slug it out at Red Bull for another year?
I would have thought it's untenable to stay at Red Bull for both Mark and Red Bull and Vettel. I'd have thought they need a change there now, and Mark needs to get out of there. I think he's fast enough to still attract a very top line Formula One seat, and I think it'd be a shame if he bails it to sports car. I think if he does, though, he'll have 5 years of top dog at, say, Porsche, and he loves Le Mans, despite, I think, his aerial activities there.
Yeah, that was, what year was that?
99.
Yeah,
on two consecutive laps. I mean, I agree. I still think Mark is very underrated. I mean, people used to say when he was at Jaguar, oh, he's no good at racing. Well, the thing was, he'd put a shed on the front or first or second row, and then, because he could get the performance out of it over one, like, well, it's no surprise that McLaren's and Williams is a queuing up behind him in a race. But I think he's very underrated generally. I think he's a good racer. I think he's fast enough. But if he did go to Porsche on a multi-year deal, for example, he then has the chance, you know, he becomes a Porsche ambassador, and, you know, for the rest, that sets him up for life, doesn't it? I mean, it would be a fantastic thing at this stage of his career to do, just in view, looking at the bigger picture.
I agree. I love sports car racing, of course. It's where I had the most success in my career, and I I love going to watch it now with my son racing in the World Endurance Championship. So it's not a, there's no shame in becoming a lead driver in a fully work supporter team in the World Endurance Championship.
With, and you like, can drive flat out for 6 hours or 24, which isn't necessarily the case where it is at the moment.
It is flat out. You watch. I went to Spa and stood beside the track, walked around the track for 3 hours. They are flat out for 6 hours.
Yeah, I was at Silverstone and watching McNish in the late laps, you know, chasing, was it Trelleway, wasn't it? Yeah. And I thought, geez, I tell you what it reminded me of Austin last year, which I really, really enjoyed because that was Lewis absolutely dug in and going for it. And
relentless. A one-stop race, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, it was, as a matter of fact, but it was a hell of a good race, wasn't it? Yeah.
It was two blokes absolutely on it. I mean, neither of them was giving an inch, and it was lap after lap, absolutely on the limit.
It was pure determination by Lewis, because he's convinced that Vettel's overrated.
Well, I think, and Fernando the same. I mean, they both rate each other the best, don't they?
Yeah. I haven't heard it from Lewis, but I'm pretty sure.
Wouldn't you love to see Kimi in the other Red Bull next year?
Yeah, I would. We always say that there's the real greats, there's three of them, don't we? I think you've got to add, that's become four. In my view now, I think you've got to add Raikkonen.
And the thing is, Kimi wouldn't give a toss about Helmut Marko about anything, would he?
No, he doesn't care about anything, mate. But does he really want to leave Lotus? I mean, he seems so happy there. He's getting the... Seems we've got the best out of Kimi. And, you know, why would he go? He's got the PR.
Well, I know for a fact that when he was driving for Ferrari, he used to really enjoy Red Bull's post-race parties on Sundays.
Well, I can't confirm that. Yeah. There is that.
I think if he could be in an environment where he didn't have to do too much PR and what have you, then you've got to look at if you were Kimi, you've got to look at Lotus and think they've lost James Allison. There's, you know, they didn't make payroll 1 month last year. There's still always talk about, they're bringing new sponsors in. There's enough peril there that if you got offered another equally good, if not better, front running seat that looked in a totally well-funded, well-structured team, especially with the new engines coming along, you'd have to grab it if you were Kimi.
What I find so interesting about Kimi's performance since he's come back from rallying is that before he left, when he was at Ferrari, he'd have one good weekend, then one disaster, and he was so inconsistent. But the greatest thing this time is his consistency. I mean, he's never off the podium.
I know, but as someone said, of course, he's on quite a lowly retainer now, but on a hell of a good dollars per point rate.
I think he is. I think it's a good incentive to finish the race, but it's working, isn't it? But I also think he realised he'd blown it before. He went off to, you know, the time you've dug a few cars out of the snow, hit a tree or two, and it's been muddy and cold, and all of a sudden Formula One must have looked magnificent when you got your shovel out in the Swedish forest or something.
You've been rallying, was it Cosworth that you drove?
And Toyota, yeah.
Yeah, how? I mean, you sort of first-hand experience. How does a circuit driver start working in rallying and racing in rallying? It must be a complete nightmare, surely, because you're suddenly relying on someone else.
It's the hardest thing I've ever done behind the wheel of a racing machine, by some margin, I would say. Yeah, the course changes, the weather. You wreck it in the daylight, do it at night, wreck it in the rain, do it in the snow. I don't know how they do it. I just think they have the greatest skill of any racing driver in the world. I think the rally drivers.
Yeah, it's that utter belief that your co-driver is telling you the right thing to do. I suppose it must be a hard thing to get your head round.
Well, it is, and not only is he telling you to go flat out, he's telling you three corners in advance, so you're busy driving, you've got to drive those three corners and remember what he said about what comes up next, because you've got to have the car set up. And it's just so immensely difficult to do, I have to say. It's so easy to make a mistake.
I thought those remarks of Loeb's were interesting about saying that, in his opinion, as a rally driver, Kubica is on another planet compared with Kimi. But in fact, Anthony Davidson said he'd been talking to Sarrazin about Kimi's, you know, what he'd heard about Kimi's rally days, and he said, well, the problem was Kimi never really had any interest in pace notes.
Mm. Well, I mean, you can't really do that, can you?
It's
couldn't be bothered with them.
Pace notes to a rally driver are like drafting to an NASCAR driver. It's just a core part of what you're going to do. But I think without doubt, Kubica would be number five on our list of not fifth on the list, but of the list of five, he'd be in there.
No question at all. I mean, Lewis has always said that he was the toughest, fastest guy he came up against in the junior categories, and I mean, look at 2010, three proper drivers' tracks, Suzuka, Spa, Monaco. He was on the front row at Monaco and the second row at the other two, in a car that had no business being anywhere near there. Mm. You know, he places where he could make a difference, he did.
McLaren, to wind you sort of back to Formula One, what's going on with McLaren? They have an incredible budget, incredible facilities. They have a good team. Okay, they've lost Paddy Lowe. What was it, 98, the last Constructors' Championship? And they've had Lewis as the driver, Alonso. Where's, you know, Martin, where's it going wrong?
I don't... You walk around the place, I've been there just 2 hours ago, and you wonder how anybody could ever beat that team, as I did even in the old factory when I walked around it in 1994 when I joined them. And they're a good bunch of people. And then I see a lot of faces around that I've known for 20, 30 years in that team. And they... It just seems impossible that they don't have, at all times, pretty much one of the fastest cars, if not the fastest car. I don't know. I don't know if it's the... They've got a system. They operate under a matrix system there of management. They there's something doesn't quite click, isn't there, really? I admire them for having a go with their 2013 car, not just sitting on their laurels of what looked like a very good 2012 car, although, of course, that might well prove to be a mistake, although Williams and Sauber don't look... You know, they've lost ground as well, haven't they? Others have lost ground. Something's changed in 2013 that's caught a lot of people out. And... You know, you have to look at McLaren and say, if we say we think there's four creme de la creme drivers, three of them have passed through McLaren, and the best designer in the Formula One designer in the world has passed through McLaren. Why didn't they stick? I think for me that's the question about McLaren. Why didn't those people want to stick there for their careers?
It still surprises me, though, quite honestly, after what Ferrari went through last year, that for this last year of this formula, McLaren decided to, you know, to go radical, if you like, pull Rod Fronden and everything else, knowing it was only for one season, and they had a very, very good car at the end of last year.
It's odd, isn't it? Hindsight's a wonderful thing.
I admire it, but...
It didn't make sense now, and you wonder how it made sense then, is what you're saying, and I agree with you.
I'm sure Martin Whitmarsh could probably pinpoint the meeting when they decided to go... There's a radically different car this year, because I'm sure he thinks back to it occasionally. He must do.
Yeah, they didn't need to take a gamble, did they? But then, you know, it's very easy to sit around this table overlooking the Thames as we are and knocking it about like a football before we move on to the next point. You know, those decisions would have been taken at McLaren based on a lot of data, a lot of R&D, a lot of clever people saying we can improve this and whether we're wrong.
It's true, but still this year of, you know, above just about any other, you know that every team is sort of half thinking of the year, hence much more than, you know, than usual.
Yes, I come back to my point. It doesn't look a good decision now, and you wonder how it did back then, but it clearly did somebody.
But it's just the sport's essence, isn't it? People always striving to find, you know, a fractional gain here, there or anywhere.
More than ever, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's just the essence of the sport.
It is, and you have to admire them for it. But there's something wrong in the decision-making process. They turn up with too many cars that they need to spend the first half season getting sorted out. Now, whether it's correlation... So what I don't understand is if your wind tunnel and your virtual wind tunnel, the track and the stopwatch and the driver, if they correlate towards the end of 2012, why do they not correlate in 2013? So how can they start deviating? It seems odd to me.
I'm sure in 20 years we'll look back and everyone will say that how weird it was when we couldn't work these things out, as they always do. Take some more questions. We got one from CJ Ogard, I think that is. Have the 2013 F1 rookies disappointed so far this year? I certainly don't think Bianchi's disappointed, and Bottas is in a car that doesn't really allow him to look good.
No, the Williams has not been good, has it, unfortunately. Bottas looks like he's sort of a match for Maldonado, doesn't he, roughly speaking? I think Chilton's got on terms with Bianchi to an extent. Now, Gutierrez looks a bit out of his depth, although he led a race, for goodness sake, in Barcelona.
And got the fastest lap, didn't he?
And got the fastest lap.
Sort of a commentary on the state of things.
Started 19th, finished 11th, and got fastest lap and led the race.
I presume fastest lap because he put a new set of rubber on about four laps from the end or something like that.
So, I don't think they've really shone. Bianchi in the early stages, I think, was outperforming his car, just as we saw Webber do in a Minardi and Alonso do in a Minardi. So let's see how it goes. But, you know, Chilton definitely coming back at him.
Yeah. We mentioned it just there, Adrian Lee, what has gone wrong with Williams in the last few seasons? We've talked about McLaren. We don't want to keep talking about teams that it's not working out for at the moment. But Williams, the Spanish Grand Prix was the perfect example. This year, didn't make it out of Q1, and last year won the race. So, I mean,
I know it's, I don't know. I think we all wish Williams could get back on the pace, don't we? And especially with the things that, you know, that happened to the Williams family in recent times. And I don't know. It's worrying there because it's a spiral, isn't it? You don't get the sponsors because you're not getting the success. So you lose key people. You can't invest in the R&D. And it's a vicious circle. And I fear Williams are, you know, deeply into that vicious circle at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, it's a tough job for Claire to step into.
A very tough job, and I know they tried quite well. I believe they were trying to get James Allison there, which would have been quite a coup. And they're trying to put some key people back into the place. And the spirit must be very. I haven't been to Williams for a while, so I don't know. And again, I would think it'd be like McLaren. You'll go around there and there'll be some really top guys and girls who know which way's up when it comes to making and running a Formula One car. But it's missing some key ingredients.
Do we know where James Allison's going yet? Has that been announced?
Ferrari, isn't it?
I assume he's going,
yeah. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's Ferrari.
Montezemolo was very outspoken in saying that there was absolutely no deal done, but that was 2 weeks ago.
But he was there, what, 5 years was he before, Simon? Was it five
years?
Yeah,
4 or 5 years. Yeah.
And certainly got people, on with it pretty well.
People I know who usually know these things in the paddock, they're pretty categoric that he's going to Ferrari. Find out.
Well, while we're on Ferrari, Massa, he's an amazing turnaround. And if I get this, if I'm right, it was mostly psychological last year when he just could not match Alonso. And he did go and talk to someone about that, but it's a revolutionary change, the Massa this year to Massa the beginning of last year, isn't it?
Yeah, confidence is everything, isn't it, in sport? It doesn't matter whether you're swinging a golf club or you're taking a penalty in the final penalty of a shootout in a big competition, or you're on the grid in Monaco in a Formula One car. You have to be confident. And if you haven't got that, you're tight in the car, every little time, every little thing the car does, you overreact to, and there's no doubt about it. Also, if, say, a particular car, its balance, its characteristics, the grip, the way the tyres work, if it all starts suiting your driving style, you might want to take a lot of speed. You might be a late breaker, or you might want to take a lot of speed into the apex and sort it out, or slow in, quick out, whatever you, however you happen to like to drive. If suddenly the car works with that, you go from zero to hero in a hurry. But I do think it's a confidence thing with him as well.
winding it back a bit to Le Mans last year. Last year you signed for Sky, went to every single Grand Prix, and also raced at Le Mans. I mean,
and Silverstone.
And Silverstone.
Yep. I mean, and Goodwood.
Yes, of course, and Goodwood. Are you enjoying life now more than you did as an F1 driver, or do you still miss sort of the F1 grid, as it were?
I loved Le Mans last year, sharing with my son, and I enjoyed Silverstone even more because I really felt dialed in. Our car wasn't really quick at Le Mans. The Zytec didn't suit the long straights, but it did very much suit Silverstone. The competitive juices will not give up, unfortunately. I cannot get rid of them.
You did enjoy the Porsche curves, though, didn't you?
Yes, I did. That. And I loved Daytona in 2011 as well. I mean, that was another race. I do not remember one lap in Daytona 24 hours where I wasn't as fast as I could possibly go. Those races are extraordinary. But I think, but there's no pressure, is there? Because you're not driving for a career. You haven't actually got to impress anybody except for yourself when you're out there. So you're doing it for the love of it rather than, you know, has he spotted me? Will I be able to get this new contract? You know, did I see them talking to somebody else and all of that? So you get this, so I can operate at almost a professional level without the pressures, professional pressure, if you like. So, but I miss being an F1 driver. I'd still love to be doing that. And I will have a big smile on my face. I mean, even just driving the F3 car the other day, my old F3 car, I mean, I love driving that as well. So I still see myself as a racing driver who does TV rather than a TV person.
Mm. And do you still find it easy to get on the pace straight away, or is, you know, is that something that's become tougher over the years?
I think I'm technically a better driver now than I was, because I've learned so much. Things I used to do instinctively that I now have watched over the years, working with DC or Gary Paffett, or watching with my son, or things I've read about braking profiles and how you turn into a corner. And I didn't know any of that before. I just used to do it and it felt right, and the stopwatch confirmed it or it didn't. And then we start to get some data acquisition and what have you. So I think technically I drive better now than I did then, because I've learned so much since that stopped.
Actually, Martin, that interests me in terms of, you say, you know, I just did it, and according to the lap times, I was doing it right. And it's interesting that having done it like that for a long, long time, there are still things that may not have come completely naturally to you, but which actually, you know, which work better.
There could have been, yeah.
And surprise you. I mean, have you really learned a lot about driving?
Well,
fairly recently.
Yes, in the last few years, I have, because I would approach a braking zone now in a much more technical way than I did before. I used to brake when it instinctively felt right, jockey the thing down through the gearbox by blipping the throttle and hoping the rear wheels didn't lock up, carry as much speed as I instinctively thought I could get away with to the apex. But now, if you brake 3 meters too early, somebody's telling you exactly with a piece of graph paper how much time it's cost you. You have to be, you know, I think that the drivers, they don't have to worry anymore about the setup of the car and understanding it. They don't have to shift gear. There's a lot of things they don't have to do anymore. That whereas a driver before, you were a fundamental, you were a key part in the development of your car. Now it's done by computers and simulators, and you turn up at the racetrack and your car is fundamentally set up for you. It's just fine tuning. I think their skills are in a different place now, and that is in an accuracy that we never used to have. How often do you see drivers making big errors and flying off the road anymore? You don't, do they? They're brilliantly reliable and consistent, I'd say.
I was going to say, I mean, back in when you were sort of on your career stepladder, you presumably be Alden Park or something, right? You break third tree on the left. Now, when you were racing at Le Mans and Silverstone last year, do you find that as you're approaching your braking zone, you've got a telemetry graph in your mind, or are you still using physical reference points?
No, you're using physical reference points, but, you know, how hard I'm going to hit the pedal in the early phase of the braking and then release the pressure and then maybe put a little bit more pressure on. I mean, it's far more complex in an F1 car because the bias is moving through the braking zone as well. So, yeah, I do. I approach the corners differently, but more in a more mechanical fashion than I used to. But you said, did I have a problem getting up to speed? Fundamentally, I still have roughly the same pace I think I had before. Where I found it difficult was, for example, when we went to the first test in Paul Ricard's scene was on the long straight, the Alto. Senior was flat out in top gear, and it took me quarter of an hour to build up to that.
And fair enough.
Well, and I can't pretend I ever felt...
I think us three would still be going round.
I can't pretend I felt super comfortable. Cops in the Zytec was flat in top as well, and that took me a little while to build up to that. It's just believing the things will stick. And all of a sudden, the barriers, as you get older, the barriers do look closer. There's no doubt about it. I mean, when I look, if you look on YouTube at my crash into back in the Tyrrell, yeah, or my crash in Imola when the brake pads fell out down the pit straight, and that sort of thing, it's like, you know. And then, why did we get in them? Why did we even get in the cars, let alone leave the pits?
I can remember that the Tyrrell coming past me on its side.
Yeah.
Cockpit towards me, towards the fence, and your helmet scudding along the tarmac.
Was he talking at the time?
He wasn't. No. He then went back and tried to have a conversation with Ken about where he was and which circuit he was at.
Yeah, and they stopped me going out in the spare car.
That was... Jesus, you know.
But you got into the spare car, didn't you?
I got in the spare car,
but then asked where you were.
And they fired it up, and I couldn't remember where to go when I got to the end of the pit lane. So they stopped. But if you watch, when they push that, it's on YouTube, when they push the car, the marshals just slam it back onto under tray, because it's got no wheels on at this point. And my head, because I'm out for the count, and my arm's hanging out the side of the thing. A miracle.
It's if you go to a motorcycle racing paddock, I mean, almost everybody has a limp. It's conspicuous in the contemporary F1 paddock that most 80s F1 drivers, yourself, Jacques Lafitte, Mark Sura,
Johnny Herbert.
Johnny Herbert, yeah. You see, you're all hobbling along.
Yeah, Well, because we used to be sat at the front, didn't we, to counterbalance the weight of the engine, and so we were one of the early things to meet the barrier.
I think the most inexplicable thing I've ever seen at a racetrack was at Vegas, and Tombay had a huge accident. I think it was in practice. And essentially the front of the car was gone, you know, from the forward of the cockpit, just nothing. Mm. And Patrick literally just stood up and walked out of the front of it. And I've never understood how that could... No. How could that have happened? The front of the car wiped off and his legs and feet...
Well, I mean...
Okay.
I was reading up Ready for Monaco, and it was the first 19 years they raced, there were no barriers, were there?
No.
Until 69, they didn't have barriers.
No, I remember Rodriguez having an accident out of... let me think. Mirabeau. There were some photographers coming out of that corner. It was just the curb, and there was no barrier at all. There was the curb and then the wall. And there were photographers taking pictures, standing on the outside, you know, people coming out of... and these two guys, I remember, had a huge camera bag between them, and they lugged it. They picked it up and lugged it down towards the hairpin. And truly, within not more than a minute, Pedro flew off the road coming out of Mirabeau and slammed into the wall exactly where they'd been.
Wow. But what are we missing
and
now?
And nobody moved. I mean, nobody sort of thought, God, that was close, you know. Everybody said, is he all right?
Somebody will look back at this era and go, I can't believe they used to do that.
Oh, because you're absolutely right.
We can't believe they used to race without seatbelts, without roll bars, without, you know, all the things, proper crash helmets, barriers, and all of that. You know, now I can't believe whether we used to race without hands devices or crash structures or fuel cells that didn't burst every time you hit something. Presumably, in 20 years' time, somebody will look back at the lunacy of what we do now, will they?
But I mean,
I'm sure they will.
MotoGP is still the same. Crutchlow finishing on the podium this last weekend with a fractured shin.
Yeah.
And his quote after practice, when he had the crash, said, well, the shin's really sore because it was right by my knee, and I had bruised lungs, I had bruised something else, and I was coughing off a bit of blood, but, you know, we race motorcycles. Mm. Then he put it fourth on the grid.
I mean, second in the race.
Yeah. Unbelievable. No, we haven't got long left, so I must take some more questions. We'll go maybe rewind a bit. I've got one here from Dominic Malvin. It's now 30 years since your epic British F3 battle with Ayrton. What is your defining memory of that season?
My defining memory of that season?
It's probably the bottom of a Rolls RT3 just above you, isn't it?
With his side pod on my shoulder so I couldn't get out of the car at Alton Park. I'm just doing a book. Funny you should mention that. I'm just doing a book. There's a whole chapter on that season. And it was really enlightening looking back and hearing from other people and reminding myself of all the things that went on that year. I think it will be winning at Silverstone, where I very first beat Senna. I think he beat me 9 straight times, and then I beat him. And it just transformed probably my career, actually, in my life at that point, because I suddenly had this thought, I can beat him, this confidence. And he knew exactly the opposite. He knew that I could beat him. And it just turned the season on its head. And then the rest is history. We both went straight to F1. So I would think it'd be that moment I came in, I was trying to get points in the British Championship. So would I have won the British F3 Championship if I'd have carried on that trajectory? Probably not. I came in, I said to Eddie, because we were easily fastest, because Senna went on the European tyres, we were easily fastest in the British category that was going to score me maximum points that weekend for the British category. And I came and said, but we were like 8th or 9th overall or something. Like, Eddie, let's go European. So we'd already used up a lot of our tyres. We bolted a set of Yokohamas on it and I stuck it on pole. I remember as soon as you just lifted a little bit for Beckett's, you didn't lift the throttle again until the Woodcote chicane, if you got it absolutely right. So Stowe and Club around here were absolutely flat out. It was brilliant. And it stuck. And then Senna crashed trying to stay with me. And I won the race. And I often think, well, should I have just taken the British points that day? But I think psychologically it then put me it just turned my career around.
Motor racing is full of what ifs. We've got another one here from Tom Power. If Flavio had extended your contract by a few years rather than getting Patrese in the Benetton, what do you think you could have achieved? I'd say that hiring Patrese rather than yourself is the worst driver decision Flavio ever made. Do you agree?
He dumped Johnny Herbert as well, didn't he? Which I don't think was very smart, although Johnny was still recovering from his injuries. I think I would have won a lot of races and I could have become world champion if Flav didn't part company. I got caught up in a very unfortunate situation where the Italians were moaning at flat. You know, you call yourself an Italian team, you race under a British license, a British factory, Scottish team principal, South African and English designers, an English and German driver. You know, which bit of that is Italian? And I think if you look, he changed it quite significantly for the following year, and they entered under an Italian license with an Italian driver, and so on and so forth. So I got caught up also in the battle between Tom and Flavio and any number of things, and people didn't realize how good Michael Schumacher was at the time. So I got to the end of it. Well, I didn't get to the end of the year because I was a journalist came up to me in August in Hungaroring and asked me what I was doing the following year. I said, I hoped I was driving for Benetton, of course. He said, well, don't you know they've already signed Patrese? So I didn't get to the end of the year and find out. I found out through the media that that Flav was going to do that, which rather confirms the Italian media situation. It was a great shame because I was on I'd sort of found my way. It's the first time I'd been in a competitive Formula One car after 8 years, and it needed a reset in my mind. And also handling Michael Schumacher wasn't the work of a moment either. But I did get on top of it, and it was. And I never. If you look at my career after that, it was Ligier, McLaren, a bad seat at McLaren, Ligier again. Then Ligier, then Jordan. I never got it back. Having said that, that weekend in Monza when I finished second to Ayrton and I beat Michael, as far as I was concerned, I was going to Williams the following year. And curiously, Ayrton leant over on the podium in Monza and said to me, so we're going to be teammates next year then. So we both thought we were going to Williams because Nigel that weekend had said he was going to IndyCar racing. And I'd already been in discussion with Frank anyway. So I thought the deal was pretty much done deal. Then I find out I'm going to be sharing the team with Ayrton, which I thought would be brilliant, to be honest. But of course, neither of us ended up there in 93.
Actually, for what it's worth, just while we're talking about Flavio, he's not necessarily the greatest guy in the world for admitting he was wrong. But he did, I remember interviewing him a few years ago, and he did say in the course of it, getting rid of you was the biggest single mistake he made in all his time.
That's right.
Running a team.
Oh, that's sweet.
Easy to say now.
He said, I never understood, I never realised how good the guy was.
Yeah, but, you know, I didn't do a good enough job to make sure.
I have to get Patrese to find out.
Yeah. If I'd have done a stronger job in the early part of the season or something, then it might have been a no-brainer. But I got caught up in something that was much bigger than just being the racing driver in the team.
I think we're going to have to call a time to it because we really are an hour and over. Martin, thanks so much for coming in and enlightening us all on modern and past stories. Now, before you all go, we are currently closing our July issue, which is a Le Mans Spectacular. So do look out for that in shops at the end of the month in the UK and all over the world on the digital edition as well. In fact, just quickly, don't forget that we have a digital edition for Apple and Android tablets. Now, that's really exciting news. So whatever tablet you have, you can read Motorsport Magazine on it. Just go to the website and find out a little bit more. For now, it's goodbye from me, Ed Foster. Goodbye from Martin Brundle. Goodbye from Simon Aaron. And goodbye from Nigel Roebuck.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.